Thank you. Be seated. Justice Abbott is recused from consideration of this case. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Van Horn versus Chambers.
May it please the court, Mr. Dean Shaver will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case presents the question of whether a physician should owe a duty that transcends the physician-patient relationship. On the facts of this case, the duty would be unprecedented, and specifically unprecedented under Texas law. The duty would also effectively require an obligation of clairvoyance on the part of an attending neurologist, Dr. Van Horn. My name is Dean Schaefer. I represent Dr. Van Horn, whose summary judgment at the trial court should be affirmed by, or reinstated by this court. By way of background, this case begins with Dr. Van Horn's patient, Mr. Johnny Long. In April of 1991, Mr. Long presented to Herman Hospital with a condition of seizure disorder. He had suffered several seizures that day and came to the emergency room in a combative state, disoriented, and was suffering badly from the seizures. He was admitted into the hospital through the emergency room and eventually transferred into the neurology critical care unit. And within the NCCU, it was determined that his medications for seizures were out of the line. He was under two medications, Dilantin and Tegretol. The physicians determined that they were out of equilibrium, and the mode of treatment was to bring the medications back into alignment. He was admitted on April 20. As of April 21, with the adjustment of medications, he was noted to be pleasant and cooperative in the NCCU. As of April 22, he continued this positive trend, had stabilized in the critical care unit, and was prepared for transfer to a private room. Thereafter, on April 23, a bizarre chain of events took place that the attending neurologist, Dr. Van Horn, simply could not have predicted. Effectively, although the sequence is somewhat unclear, it appears what occurred is that Mr. Long, while in his private room, was engaged in a confrontation. The confrontation moved from the room out into the hall, traversed up and down the hall. Several members of the security team were called. When they arrived on the scene, Mr. Long eventually struck one of the members of these people of this team that appeared in the face. And at that time, all members of the team descended on Mr. Long. He crashed through a louvered wall panel, and what nobody knew at the time, including Dr. Van Horn, was that that louvered wall panel concealed an air shaft. Four people fell down the air shaft, 24 feet. Two of the people died. Two others were injured. Suit subsequently ensued against the hospital and against Dr. Van Horn and others. The claim against Dr. Van Horn is brought by those who claim an injury from the fall down the air shaft. And the theory is that Dr. Van Horn should somehow have prevented this bizarre chain of events through the treatment of his patient.
Is there related litigation involving this action? Not everybody's here in this case.
That's right. There was a series of lawsuits, as I understand it. Dr. Van Horn was the last defendant named, to my knowledge. Of the four people who fell down the air shaft, three raised a claim against Dr. Van Horn. We obtained summary judgment as to all three at the trial court. Two of those parties have appealed, that is Chambers and Johnson, who are here today. There was other litigation involving the fourth person who fell down the air shaft, a medical resident.
The third person that you mentioned earlier is no longer a patient.
That's right. That's right. when we look at this unusual set of facts, it is somewhat surprising as I researched this matter that the law in this area does follow a somewhat logical sequence. And we have brought an exhibit to the court today, and I believe you have copies up at the bench, that sets out in a very summarized fashion the way the law is developing in this area. We are presented with a tort situation where, much like in law school, we have general rules and what appear to be some emerging potential exceptions to the general rule. The general rule, as we've stated on the exhibit, begins with what I would consider the largest column of considerations, which is that a physician should not be accountable for alleged medical malpractice in the absence of a physician-patient relationship. And that is really just an issue. The only reason that I bring that to the court's attention today is that there is a notion of standing when it comes to any kind of medical malpractice-related action. The second, more specific tenet of this general rule was stated recently by this court in the Byrd case. Justice Enoch writing for the court held that there is no duty on the part of a treating health care provider. In the Byrd case, it was specifically a psychotherapist, to not negligently misdiagnose a patient. That is, no duty that runs to third parties. Now, from those principles of the general rule, our position is that's as far as this court needs to go. The general rule is, even if we accept everything that the plaintiffs say is true, Dr. Van Horn owed no duty that could extend to third parties to not negligently misdiagnose a patient. We presented summary judgment proof to the court that clearly and conclusively establishes that Dr. Van Horn was in compliance with the standard of care. But even if we accept allegations that he was not, that he somehow misdiagnosed the patient, Byrd stands for the proposition that there is not a duty that will translate to third parties.
If this patient had been involuntarily committed and was under an order of commitment and this doctor had released the patient, would we have a different situation?
We would have a very different situation.
And should we oppose the duty under those circumstances? What's the difference?
I think in that situation, in any situation, any hypothetical that the court will consider, we're eventually going to get to this six-part test. That's on the second part of our exhibit here, the six-part test that balances foreseeability factors against the social factors that this court must consider whenever it imposes a legal fee. But in the case presented in that hypothetical, a hypothetical that I think is very similar to a case this court also dealt with recently, the Kerrville State Hospital case. In the case of a commitment order, and if we could add to the hypothetical the kind of commitment order that we had in Kerrville State Hospital, where there's a judicial declaration that a person is a serious threat, imminent danger to people, and that's so declared by a court, we've got a very different situation where the risk of injury, the foreseeability of harm, and the seriousness of that type of harm is much greater than the type of situation presented for Dr. Van Horn back in 1991.
So if they wrestled out the hallway, almost falling out of the shaft the day that Dr. Van Horn was there, what might happen?
Foreseeability is always going to be premised on what the actor knows or should have known.
There's a foreseeability as to duty, and there's a foreseeability as to cause.
Yes, sir.
And the latter is case-specific, and the former question of law, categories and cases. How do you differentiate that? Is it as simple as saying that if Dr. Van Horn had been standing there when they almost got hurt the day before, he might have had no duty and therefore liability in this circumstance?
I think when we talk about foreseeability in the context of legal duty, we're looking at what Dr. Van Horn knew at the last time that he dealt with the patient. At that time, the patient's stable, transfers made. When we're talking about foreseeability in the context of causation, proximate cause kind of issues. I think we can get into the issue of, well, what could have been. And that's where we get to some of the other significant facts in this case, such as who could have ever expected that this tumult would have worked its way down the hall, crashed through a louvered wall panel that concealed an air shaft that nobody knew about either.
But the creation of duty doesn't necessarily depend on foreseeing the actual playing out of events, though, and it's just foreseeability that if you don't adequately restrain an agitated patient, that he can hurt someone. You may not foresee that they fall down an elevator shaft or an air shaft, but you might foresee harm to another person. Isn't that the kind of thing we look at on the duty side, not the specifics of a given case?
Well, on the duty side, yes, sir. On causation, there is ultimately some limit.
But we're here talking about duty.
Absolutely. In this case, again, back to the way that you phrased the question, you've got to look to the issue of, was there a duty to restrain? Was there any knowledge, any foreseeability on the part of Dr. Van Horn that at the time of the injury-producing event, this patient needed...
But you're saying there is a duty if there is some evidence that there was an indication the patient was violent. But there is a duty if there is bad evidence.
I'm not going quite that far, Your Honor. I'm saying that is going to be one of the considerations in this balancing test. And if there is some evidence that the patient is representing a serious threat, imminent harm, then those foreseeability factors are going to start to weigh down.
So that's a fact question for the jury as to whether there was foreseeability of imminent harm in this case.
In this case, and in any duty case, it's ultimately going to be a question for the judge, for the court. That's my understanding. Duty.
What I just understood you to say, that physicians do have a duty where there's imminent foreseeability of harm to take some action to restrain the patient.
No, Your Honor, I didn't mean to state it like that. My response is that is one consideration. We have on the alternate side the social factors. The social factors about what is the utility of the doctor's conduct in the situation. What is the magnitude of the burden to place a duty on the physician to guard against this injury?
And I'm trying to, in my own mind, draw to see where there's a distinction between a commitment order and actual knowledge that a patient is dangerous, where there's no commitment order.
In the instance of a commitment where it's, and let's just, I think we would have to assume it's an active commitment order, like was the case in Purville State Hospital case. You have that added assurance, a judicial declaration that this person is a serious threat of imminent harm to other people. In the kind of situation that we have, there is no imminent threat. There is no threat of serious injury and no voice.
So what if there is? There's no commitment order, but there are facts from which a jury could say there was an imminent threat. Do you have a duty under that circumstance?
Again, I think it's going to depend on this countervailing set of considerations, what we call the social factor.
And how do you balance that out? Do you have a duty or not?
I think there we look at the type of patient that we're dealing with. We look at the type of physician and the expertise that physician brings. We look at the other circumstances and the whole totality of circumstances. If the physician happens to be a psychiatrist whose specialty is in determining whether somebody is a serious threat and whether they ought to be subject to a commitment order, it's a different set of considerations than if we've got a neurologist who's treating seizure disorder.
Sure.
Also, yes, sir.
Let me interrupt. Something that concerns me in trying to understand facts in this case and the law. Let me give you a hypothetical. I go to the hospital because I have some ailment. I stay in the hospital a day. The doctor hasn't bothered to come by and see me. I get agitated. I feel better. I said, adios. I'm out of here.
What gives the hospital personnel any right to restrain a person who's volunteering in the hospital? Mr. Long, for example. Mr. Long goes there, heads that state, his medication's out of whack, he is stabilized, for whatever reason. Is he free to leave? And what gives the hospital personnel any authority to try to tackle him and by force restrain him there? What?
In that instance, in the absence of some kind of confinement order.
Well, there was no confinement order here. Well, Mr. Long was free to leave.
That's correct.
Now, why shouldn't the hospital personnel and Van Horn and anybody else have something to do with this case not be responsible for the conduct that develops after the fact in trying to restrain an individual who's free to leave?
I think in that case, we are getting so remote from the treating physician, and that the focus should instead turn on those people who deem it at the time to be a security threat, and look to whether are we creating a false imprisonment situation? Is there actually an active, imminent threat of serious danger? That's a set of considerations for the security folks who are called to the scene. When those considerations are not even...
We're not acting under Dr. Van Horn's orders or directions or instructions.
These are intervening events that no one can predict. There is a case in Texas that we discussed in the briefs, the Williams case out of El Paso, that specifically declined to recognize the duty on the facts of that case. When a patient climbs the wall of a state hospital and runs out onto the street, the court talked about how you just cannot account for unpredictable patient behavior.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Gail Oler will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, this is a summary judgment case. It was a negligence case that we disposed of on summary judgment on the basis that there was no duty on the part of Dr. Van Horn to exercise reasonable care to guard against injury to Ron Chambers and Edward Johnson.
Mr. Oler,
yes.
The facts of this case, what is it that you're saying that Dr. Van Horn failed to do that he should have done?
He failed to exercise reasonable care.
What does that mean? Connect the dots for me. What specifically did Dr. Van Horn fail to do?
He failed, in the first place, to control a person that was within his charge and care that had known dangerous propensities in violation of Section 319 of the Restatement and in violation of Otis Engineering against Clark and the teaching of this court in the Kerrville hospital case.
The patient was stabilized.
Well, let me address that. That is an incorrect statement, not by the court, because the court's picking that up from Dr. Van Horn. This patient, and let me talk about the time here, this because counsel was a day off on this time. This patient came to Herman Hospital at 8 o'clock on April 20th. On April 21st, he was transferred to the Neurological Critical Care Unit where Dr. Van Horn became his attending physician. He stayed there until the evening of the 22nd, which is the next day. And Dr. Van Horn transferred him to 5 Cullen, which is a general nursing floor in the Cullen Pavilion.
He made an assessment that there was no longer a need for critical care. And the person could go to the general population for a private room or another hospital that's not as restricted.
He gave orders for transferring to 5 Cullen, and he did that at the time he discontinued the measures that were keeping this patient under control. Those were simultaneous. When he came into the critical care unit, he was restrained on all four extremities with leather restraints.
That's when he came in.
When he came in.
Were the leather restraints
with leather restraints
ever taken off?
only on the very moment he transferred it to Bicolor. There was no interval between the time he ordered the transfer and the time the leather restraints were taken off. They were taken off, and he was transferred. He didn't monitor to see if he really would.
So he went from one hospital to another hospital in shackles?
No.
Right.
No, he took the restraints off and sent him over there without restraints. Sent him over there without sedation.
How long was
sent him over there without alcohol treatment.
How long was he in the hospital where he was transferred before this?
He arrived there at 5 on the evening of the 22nd. This happened at 8 o'clock the next morning. And the hospital records say that when he arrived at 5 o'clock on the 22nd, he was agitated. Now, Dr. Van Horn comes in here and says the patient was stabilized. Before, he didn't know if he was or not. He was. Would you be stabilized if you were in handcuffs? Would you be stabilized if you were strapped down? Would you be stabilized if he was under heavy sedation?
Mr. Olivet, it's your contention that the doctor was negligent in his diagnosis of the patient.
No, it is not. We did not bring a malpractice action on this. I agree with counsel that the malpractice rules apply only in the physician-patient relationship. And I don't represent that patient. I represent the people the patient hurt and their heirs.
But for the fact that Dr. Van Horn was the patient's physician and made the decision to transfer him from the neurological ICU to the regular floor without restraint, incident would not have occurred. So the duty flows originally from the doctor-patient relationship, does it not?
We say it's a common law duty that...
Does it not flow originally from the patient-physician relationship?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that... No, I would say it is not limited to physician-patient relationship. And that's,
no, but I'm not asking. I'm asking you where the duty originates.
Oh, in the context, the factual context, Johnny Long Jr., or Sr., Johnny Long Sr., who was the patient of Dr. Van Horn, and Dr. Van Horn had charge of him, control over him, made the orders about him, stretched him down, and did all of these things.
Whether or not you call it a duty to control, whether or not you call it a duty to a patient diagnosed properly, the origination of the duty in this case arises from patient-physician relationship between Dr. Van Horn and Mr. Long.
Only to the extent that because of that relationship and the way it came in, Dr. Van Horn had control of and charge of this patient within the meaning of Section 319 of the restatement.
Okay, so it does originate then of the relationship between Dr. Van Horn and Mr.
Long. I don't think Dr. Van Horn knew him before he came in.
I'm just trying to see how this whole ball got started rolling forward, and it began as a result of a physician-patient relationship between Dr. Van Horn and Mr. Long.
Yes. Yes. But I don't think, and the reason I was quibbling a little bit with the court, is I don't think the duty that we're talking about here is a physician-patient duty. Now, counsel wants to put it in that context, but what we're talking about here is a common law duty that applies whether you're a doctor or not. And Section 319 of the restatement, just as the Otis Engineering against Clark, talks about this duty arising when a person has control over another person. And Section 319 specifically addresses if that person is dangerous. Now, it's elemental, and this court has said that people who possess and have control of dangerous things, for example, substances, explosives, electricity, the law exacts from them a duty to exercise reasonable care to protect the public from that. Now, that's the basis for Section 319 of the restatement. I mean, the predicate to it is the person has charge. That's one aspect. The other is the person in the charge is dangerous. Now, if that's the case, he has a duty to the public to exercise reasonable care, back to your question, to control the patient or control the person.
He was there voluntarily. He could have left any time. How can he possibly be under Dr. Long's control?
Well, the facts show that he was under control.
Well,
he went with orders.
Back to my question, Mr. Shiller. What does that mean? A patient who goes to the hospital can always walk away. I don't like the treatment you're giving me here. I'm leaving this hospital. So, is that true?
I think that is true.
Well, if that is true, how can you say that Mr. Long was under Dr. Van Horn's control?
He was the attending physician, Your Honor, and he gave orders, and the orders were executed and submitted to. And
was there an order here? Keep Mr. Long here at all costs. Restrain him, tackle him, do whatever it takes to keep him in the facility.
There was an order to strap him down on all four extremities. There was an order to give this man massive doses of Ativan. There was an order to give this man massive doses of Tegretol and Dilantin. There was an order to give him treatment for alcohol withdrawal syndrome. And this man is there, and he has an attending physician who is in his charge. I mean, surely I'm not going to say here that this man was not in Dr. Van Horn's charge, and surely Dr. Van Horn won't say it. He was the attending physician, and this man was violent. He came into the hospital biting, kicking, hitting, and trying to hurt people. Dr. Van Horn had charge of him. And the thing about it, Judge, is that he put the measures on that worked. They worked. He knew he had the duty, but he discharged the duty for a while.
Well, Mr. Oler, let me ask you.
Yes.
Ms. Schaefer is saying that the Byrd case really controls this. And you try and distinguish that because this isn't a misdiagnosis issue and you're not claiming that. But isn't the crux of your argument that the doctor's medical knowledge, it was the doctor's medical knowledge that gave the doctor the power to restrain this individual? The doctor's medical knowledge that sedated the individual. And ultimately, aren't we relegated to accepting that it's the doctor's medical knowledge that's in question here? Because if the medical knowledge was correct, the doctor had no basis for continuing the restraint. If the doctor's medical knowledge was incorrect, then maybe there was a basis for continuing the restraint. And ultimately, isn't this a case simply of the injured parties claiming the doctor misdiagnosed the condition of the Mr. Long and released the restraints too soon?
Your Honor, I don't think so. He correctly diagnosed him, in my view, because the measures he put on him worked, and it protected the people that were around him, and nobody got hurt until he took those measures off.
Under your theory, Mr. Oler, the straps, leather straps, and the extremities, and the restraints should have never been taken off, ever. Is that right?
No.
Oh, what?
No. But he had a duty to exercise reasonable care to control this person to protect the interests of others, and it's a fact question as to whether they should have been taken off at that time or not, whether they should be taken off without monitoring. That's what happened. What happened, all of those restraints were taken off, and he never checked. He took them off, transferred him, and when the man arrived at 5:00, he was already agitated. He was already agitated. And I think that is a question for a jury to decide. It relates not to duty as much as to causation and breach of the duty. And that's the point here is that, and I think Texas imposes a duty to exercise reasonable care for the protection of third persons in three ways. One is this restatement, Section 319. The other is the, and in that same category is Otis Engineering against Clark. But there's also the Gooden against Tips line, and that is a duty of reasonable care that arises when a doctor helps create the situation that caused the problem. In Gooden against Tips, it was prescribing a medication that made the patient drowsy when he drove. And Flynn was distinguished from that because the doctor did not help create the situation in that sentence. El Chico against Poole is in the same order with Gooden against Tiff, because there the bartender helped create the situation that caused the problem. And the third is the Tarasov situation. That is where the duty runs to the foreseeable victim of the patient, and the doctor does not have to create that situation.
You're not claiming the Tarasov's applicable here, are you? You're not claiming that that latter duty is available here, are you?
Yes.
That Dr. Van Horn could readily identify these particular people working around the hospital who this person might lash out at.
The way the law is developing on Tarasov, the Tarasov first said a readily identified victim, but the development of the Tarasov doctrine is a foreseeable, a readily identified.
I thought it was shrinking back in California.
Say again?
I thought the Tarasov was being limited by the California Supreme Court, not expanded.
Well, the Arizona court, and it's quoted in the footnote in the Court of Appeals opinion in the Kerrville State Hospital case, says that the Tarasov doctrine expands to foreseeable victims of the patient's violence. Now, injury to hospital employees was foreseeable in this case. That's what he had been doing before these restraints were put on him, before this treatment was given to him. And this doctor was aware, as everybody there in the NCCU was aware, that if this person is released, there's a potential for harm to hospital employees. Now, counsel says, but he had stabilized. Had he? That's a fact question.
If we adopt the duty you're asking, we're essentially saying people in the mental health profession are taking on a pretty heavy responsibility, aren't we? Anytime you have a mental patient who has a history of violence, it's a pretty precarious thing for the mental health professional to undertake care.
Well, I think there's some risk in there. I think it is. I think there is risk in our profession, Your Honor. I think there is risk in handling dangerous commodities, such as construction people. We don't try to shelter ourselves from all the risks. What we do is use reasonable care commensurate with the risks and dangers that are there. And that's what we say did not happen here.
Do you think imposing this kind of duty will lead to more restraint and more chemical restraint medication of mental patients?
No. No, I do not. I think it will avoid a summary. A summary release of a patient who has been under heavy restraint without some time to monitor and check it. But really, that's not for us to decide. That's for a jury to decide.
Well, Mr. Eller, the dissenting opinion below criticizes the majority opinion for not conducting a graph analysis before recognizing this duty. What is your response to the dissenting opinion below?
Yeah, and Your Honor, that's the bottom half of the chart over here. This is not a new duty that we're talking about. Graph against beard.
Well, assume it is a new duty. How would graph be applied in this instance so that this duty could be recognized? I understand that's not your position, but assume with me so that we can get your response to that dissenting opinion.
Well, I don't think that on these factors that he's got at the bottom of the seesaw, that there's anything there that is unduly burdensome, either in social utility or to the profession. And magnitude of the burden to guard against, there's no magnitude of burden in this case. They had this man. And Your Honor, what happened, as soon as this incident happened, what did they do? They put him back over there, and they put all of this same stuff back on him.
The argument that has been raised in this case, that the defense opinion talks about, and the amicus briefs in this case talk about, is the fact that we have to balance the physician's duty to treat the patient using the least restrictive means against what you are talking about, which is imposing a duty to control the patient. Can you specifically address how you would interpret that balance?
Well, let me just say, with regard to the duty to treat the patient in the least restrictive means, There is nothing in this record that says there is that deed. That's an assumption.
You're asking for us to address a question of a legal duty, which is a question of law, not a question of fact. So how would you interpret the balance? And I'm giving you a chance to respond to arguments that have been presented to us.
Sure. The matter of least restrictive means is a matter of judgment of decision. It's not a duty. Whereas the duty to exercise reasonable care to protect others from a dangerous patient is a duty. And I know the amicus agrees that, well, this puts the physician between two competing duties. Not so. Not so. There is one duty here, and this is that we're talking about here. This least restrictive means is more lawyer talk than it is anything else. Now, in summary, let me say here that the time span involved is very short. The argument that this patient was stable and ready to go to a general nursing floor was made too quick, in my view, but that's for a jury to determine. We know, and the facts are, that the restraints that had been so successful in controlling this person were taken off simultaneously with his transfer to an unsecured general floor without time to check to see if he would remain nonviolent without those restraints. By the time he got there at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he was already agitated again. And this patient had not stabilized. And the stabilization argument here is an afterthought. What we're asking this court to do is to reject Dr. Van Horn's arguments about all these things that have to be considered and focus on the established three duties that I've mentioned here. They're not new. They've been in the law a long time.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Thank you, counsel.
To follow up on your line of inquiry, Justice, three justices at the Court of Appeals and TMA in the amicus brief all would go through this duty analysis as set forth in Graff and progeny of cases up at this court. That six-part test is what controls here. There is no duty recognized in the state of Texas that would apply to Dr. Van Horn on the facts of this case. And when we look to these factors, balancing the foreseeability factors on the one hand, which are remote, as pointed out by Justice Taft in the dissent below, against these social factors on the other hand, which create immense burdens on treaters like Dr. Van Horn.
Let's talk about those factors. What do you think would be so egregious in trying to balance these factors and looking particularly at the social utility consequences, et cetera?
Let me take those in turn. The utility of Dr. Van Horn's conduct. We, as a society, want doctors to be treating seizure disorder patients. It's good for us. It's good for the seizure disorder patient. When you create the specter of liability on facts like we've got here, doctors are going to be much less inclined to treat those patients. But let me take it to a more specific level. Counsel talked about how this least restrictive means, that's something that is lawyer talk. Well, that is talk that comes directly out of the two affidavits in front of the court, affidavits by two eminently qualified neurologists who talk about you want to be treating a seizure disorder patient in the least restrictive means. And there are reasons for that. Medical reasons that certainly make sense. The patient gets better quicker.
Where does a hospital or a doctor get the authority to restrain a patient lifelong, physically restraining if it's against his will?
If we look at Mr. Long at the time that he arrives at the emergency room, if in the doctor's medical judgment that patient is posing a serious threat, an imminent threat of serious harm to himself or to others, then there, within medical judgment, there will be some steps that the physician can take. I think ultimately, if we're going to get to Justice Gonzalez's question, if you're going to confine him, ultimately you might have to get some kind of a confinement order, a commission order, which did not...
When he was put in the restraints, did his family give him that authority? And what if he said, take these off me, I'm leaving? Where's the legal authority for the doctor to say no?
His family brought him to the hospital in this disoriented state because he needed the treatment after suffering 5 seizures that day. His family was the one to get him this care. The physicians who received him in the emergency room did see that at that time he posed a danger to himself or perhaps...
And where did that come from? Just where's the legal authority?
I think in the...
Is this position to make that judgment and hold that patient against his will?
I think the doctors would say it comes from their medical judgment. Where they get the authority within the law, presumably that's the consent that comes with this physician-patient relationship. The doctor can treat the patient.
If we assume there's a duty and that it was breached, do you still win on your summary judgment because of the circumstances after the duty was breached?
We did raise causation grounds, just the unforeseeability when it comes to proximate cause, the fact that this air shaft existed that nobody knew about, that was all so remote and unknown to Dr. Van Horn in a way that he couldn't have known about, that we would argue even in those, with those findings, that we should still be entitled to summary judgment.
Would you agree that if a patient in this state comes to the hospital with his a weapon of some sort and he's allowed to keep it, that would be a breach of the duty?
I think in that instance, these foreseeability factors loom a little bit larger than what we've got here. Before I finish, I want to get back to Justice Gonzalez's question on these other points, the magnitude of the burden.
Do you want to hear that? Tell us your thoughts in a minute or less.
If I may. The neurologist can't be a clairvoyant. The magnitude of that burden is just, we can't put that burden on anybody. We can't make the doctor the insurer for the patient. And when we talk about the final factor, consequences of placing the burden on the actor, you do put the physician in a position of competing duties that creates this Hobson's choice. And the dissent talked about it. They're darned if they do and darned if they don't. And this court should not impose that kind of a duty on the facts of this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the oral argument submission for this week, and all these cases are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.